And welcome to this year's edition of what has become a festive staple here at EG, our top 10 property cases of the year. I'm Sarah Jackman, and I'm joined by my colleague in the legal and professional team, Jess Harold. Together, we have considered, debated, and ranked what we believe are the most significant court decisions involving property given in 2019.
That's right. But for anyone who has tuned into our previous annual reviews, this year we're doing things a little differently. Today we're counting down from number 10 to number 6. Then next week we will gradually reveal our top 5 in video format on the EG website. And when the top spot is finally revealed, part 2 of our podcast rundown will be made available for those who prefer the audio only format. But without further ado, it's time to begin our top 10. With number 10. Over to you, Sarah.
Thank you, Jess. It's fair to say that from a judicial perspective, 2019 has been the year of the telecoms case. Under the old code, there were only ever a handful of reported cases over a 30-year period, while under the new code, certainly at the time of recording, the Upper Tribunal has ruled on 10 in just under 2 years, two of which have been appealed to the Court of Appeal. So it's only right that we kick off our review of the year with just such a telecoms case. EE Limited versus Islington London Borough Council, determined by the Upper Tribunal in February. While many of the cases litigated have concerned access rights under the code, this one dealt with compensation, and on that basis, it's worthy of our number 10 spot. The facts are thus. EE wanted to install and operate telecoms apparatus on a property owned by Islington London Borough Council. The parties were unable to reach agreement and the case was referred to the Upper Tribunal, which determined that it had the jurisdiction to impose a new lease on the parties and did so in the form of a 10-year lease. More significantly, the case highlighted that the amounts payable to landowners as compensation under the new code may be significantly less than under the old code, given the way that code rights are now valued. As Danielle Drummond-Brassington, partner at CMS, and her co-authors remarked in an article for EG in September, while stalemates between operator and site provider valuers continue in the market, this case offers a helpful insight as to the tribunal's approach to consideration and compensation. Compensation does not need to be ordered and payable at completion of the agreement. Instead, site providers may apply for this as issues arise during the lifetime of the arrangement. However, the reality is that unless compensation is substantial, then pursuing this at a later stage may not be financially viable. While this is only part of the telecoms story, it is significant and contributes to a fast-evolving area which shows no sign of slowing in 2020. Indeed, with two cases already appealed to the Court of Appeal, it's possible that a telecoms case may eventually receive an airing at the Supreme Court.
Now for number 9, a case involving Manchester's Beetham Tower, a 47-storey glass building which has been described as the UK's first skyscraper outside London. It is reputed to have cost £150 million to construct and houses a Hilton hotel with residential flats above. But only 8 years after completion, the structural sealant used to attach the glass panels to the facade began to fail. The main contractor, Carillion Construction, investigated and came up with a temporary fix, but then entered liquidation, leading to the litigation in Blue Manchester Limited versus North West Ground Rents Limited. The tenant of the hotel called on the freeholder to comply with the repairing covenants in its 999-year lease, for which it had paid £60 million, and to provide a permanent solution to the problem. The freeholder accepted that the facade was its responsibility, but argued that it had complied sufficiently with its repairing obligations by providing the temporary fix while it pursued claims against Carillion's insurers and a subcontractor that it hoped would enable it to fund a permanent solution. But the temporary stitch plates had been designed to last for no longer 3 years, required regular inspection, causing disruption, and so the High Court found the facade was not in good or substantial repair. The judge ordered the freeholder to repair the building within an 18-month period to put it back to substantially the same external appearance as at the date of lease. Adding to the freeholder's dismay, the judge awarded damages to the tenant for the disturbance caused. Helena Davies and Ian Laurie, writing for us, said that the case, following in the wake of the Grenfell Tower disaster, highlighted how landlords can underestimate the reach of their obligations. And the decision in Blue Manchester is sure to have emboldened tenants to take action. So it will be interesting to see if more similar litigation follows in the next 12 months.
Taking our eighth spot, a business rates case, a topic that has gained an increasing prominence given the ever-increasing pressure on the high street. However, the case itself, Hewitt versus Telereal Trillium, determined by the Supreme Court in May, didn't involve a shop, but a vacant 1970s office block in Blackpool called Mexford House. The case had flip-flopped through the courts, and the key question was how rateable value should be calculated where the evidence showed at the relevant time a general demand in the area for comparable office buildings, but no actual tenant willing to pay a positive price for the building itself. The initial rateable value for the 2010 rating list with effect from 1st of April 2010 was assessed by the valuation officer as £490,000, reflecting his view that there were other office buildings in the area of similar age and quality occupied by public sector tenants at rent of the same order. However, the Valuation Tribunal for England reduced the rateable value of Mexford House to £1 because, at the antecedent valuation date, no person in the real world could be identified who would bid for the tenancy. The valuation officer lowered his final assessment of the rateable value to £370,000 and the matter went to the upper tribunal. The central issue was whether the rating hypothesis, which requires the existence of a hypothetical tenant to be assumed, also requires the rateable value to be assessed by reference to the general demand as evidenced by the occupation of other office properties with similar characteristics. The upper tribunal found that it does, allowed the valuation officer's appeal and fixed the rateable value at £370,000. The Court of Appeal unanimously allowed Telereal Trillium's appeal and restored the Valuation Tribunal's assessment of the rateable value at £1 on the basis that there was no demand for the market for occupation of Mexford House. However, the Supreme Court sided with the valuation officer by the slimmest majority. Commenting on the case at the time, business rates consultant Blake Penfold said, "The ratepayer will no doubt be disappointed by the outcome, and ratepayers of other large vacant properties may point to the suggested unreality of an outcome whereby a full value is applied to a property for which no tenant can be identified, and the valuation office may be relieved that it will not be faced with a flood of proposals seeking nominal values." But both the majority judgment and the dissenting one point to ways in which rating valuations can properly reflect an oversupply of property relative to demand for properties of that type. If this decision does no more than remind valuers of that, then it will serve an important purpose. An important decision, then, in an increasingly high-profile field. With uncertainty in the market and vacancy rates in particular sectors increasing, EG predicts that rating will continue to feature prominently in 2020.
Another Supreme Court decision takes seventh place in our rundown. Sequent Nominees Limited, formerly Rotrust Nominees Limited, versus Houtford Limited. Again, by the narrowest of margins, a 3-2 majority, the highest court in the land ruled that a landlord had been entitled to refuse consent for a retrospective planning application to change use of premises to residential, because it might leave it vulnerable to enfranchisement. Lower courts had found that the refusal of consent had been unreasonable, but the Supreme Court majority took a different view, in a decision that clarified the approach to interpretation of so-called fully qualified leasehold covenants. In this case, Sequent is the landlord of a six-storey terrace building at 51 Brewer Street, Soho. Houtford is the current tenant under a lease granted in 1986. Its subtenant, Romanies, runs an ironmonger shop from the basement and ground floor. Under a clause of the lease, the tenant may use any part of the building for retail, offices or residential purposes, while another clause of the lease says the tenant cannot apply for planning permission without the landlord's consent, which must not be unreasonably withheld. This is what is known as a fully qualified covenant. Between 2013 and 2015, the subtenant converted the first, second, third and fourth floors into self-contained flats, but the existing planning permission did not allow residential use. The tenant sought the former landlord's consent to apply for planning permission to use those floors residentially. However, the landlord took the view that a change of use would damage its own financial interests because it would potentially leave it vulnerable to enfranchisement. It refused consent. Giving the main ruling in the Supreme Court, Lord Briggs said that damage to the reversion is the quintessential type of consideration rendering reasonable the refusal of consent. He added, "A down-to-earth factual analysis of the economic consequences to the landlord of giving or refusing the requested consent in the present case plainly suggests that a refusal is reasonable." Anna Favre, partner in the residential estates team at Cripps Pemberton Greenish, told us that the case marks a landmark victory for both the appellant and commercial landlords at large. She said, "The Supreme Court decision amounts to a reversal in a recent trend of decisions suggesting withholding consent to alter, assign and change use on grounds of an enfranchisement risk is not a reasonable ground for a refusal. The implications of this case are therefore far-reaching and provide a valuable weapon in the landlord's legal armoury." The judgment, which has been described as something of a surprise by commentators, was handed down at the end of October, and, as with any decision that challenges conventional wisdom, is likely to lead to further litigation in similar cases. We await to see which landlords and tenants will be the first to clash over fully qualified covenants post-sequent.
At six, a case determined in September by Judge Pearce sitting at Manchester County Court. Its name, Neoclius and Another versus Rees. It concerned the validity of an electronic signature, an increasingly important issue in the digital age. The law relating to electronic signatures has been the subject of much debate, but the starting point is Section 2 of the Law of Property Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1989, governing the enforceability of a contract for the sale or other disposition of an interest in land. It requires the contract to be in writing, to incorporate all the terms expressly agreed between the parties in one document, and to be signed by or on behalf of the parties. What constitutes a signature for the purposes of Section 2 had already been determined by the courts, but Neoclius took case law one step further and provided guidance on the validity of a signature in electronic form. The facts of the case were straightforward. A settlement providing for a transfer of a piece of land had been agreed in a series of emails between the party's solicitors. However, one of the solicitor's purported signatures was by way of automatic generation of his name, occupation, role, and contact details on a footer at the bottom of the email. Was this sufficient to satisfy Section 2 of the 89 Act? The test was whether the solicitor's name was supplied with authenticating intent. Judge Pearce found this to be the case. Manual typing of the words "many thanks" at the end of the email indicated that the solicitor was intending to connect the automatic footer with the body of the email. As Alison Murren, expertise counsel at Ashurst, commented in a recent article on electronic signatures for EG, Judge Pearce stated that the meaning of the words tended to develop over time, and whether a signature is valid should only depend on whether it was applied with authenticating intent. Although only a county court decision, therefore not binding precedent, Judge Pearce's reasoning in Neoclius is certainly persuasive and is an endorsement that function is more important than form. With the Law Commission having reported in September on the electronic execution of documents, it is a timely reminder of how the law might be interpreted in what will surely become an ever-important field.
That completes the first half of our Top 10 Rundown. Be sure to watch the EG website each day next week as we count down the remaining five, and tune in next Friday for the full audio rundown.